May it please the court, Craig Weinberg appearing on behalf of the plaintiff appellant My Chance Company. And I would like to start by running through a couple of basic facts of the case. I know that may not be the wisest use of my time, but there's just a couple of principal facts that are involved and set that backdrop. So the defendant signed a covenant not to compete on March 1st, 2006. Trial court found that covenant was valid and enforceable principally because the defendant was a officer, director, and shareholder in the company. She resigned in October of 2012 and immediately began competing. She started working on two of the most lucrative projects that My Chance had had. They were being performed by My Chance, and coincidentally, these customers stopped their relationship with My Chance and approximately 10 days or so later started working directly with Ms. Geigel. She set up her own website. On that website, she posted photographs of projects and jobs that she had done for My Chance. She erased her computer, her business computer, and when the matter came before the district court for a preliminary injunction to stop the competition, the trial court denied that relief. So it's against that backdrop I'd like to start the argument with really the second issue that we raised in the opening brief, that it does dovetail in with the first issue, and as that comes about, we can discuss that.
Counsel, can I interrupt you before you get rolling?
Sure.
I wanted to clarify some of the facts that were raised by the suggestion of mootness that I'm sure you know about. Is My Chance conducting business in parts of Utah still?
Yes.
So it's not true that they closed the store?
The physical store was closed, but it is still servicing clients and still conducting business. It
being the store or the company?
The company. The company has a number of clients. I could read you a list of clients in Park City that it is.
So the clients are in Utah, but there's no offices in Utah.
At this particular incident time, there is no physical address, but they are trying to negotiate a new lease in Utah.
If there's not business being conducted, or if there's no physical office through which the plant does business in Utah, do we consider that, do we have to look within a 200-mile radius of Utah if the plant is not doing, not doesn't have an office in Utah?
Well, I mean, it's still conducting business. The language of the covenant not to compete.
But throughout your brief, when you say radius, you always say radius from where the office is, not radius from where the project is.
Well, it says 200 miles from any location where the company is, I believe, I'd have to pull it, but engaged in business in the state of Utah or the state of Colorado, and it is engaged.
Right. In your brief, you have the pinpointed radius as the physical office of the plaintiff. Are you changing that approach to the contract?
I don't believe I've taken the position that it's 200 miles within the physical location of the office. She can't engage in any activity, and that doesn't just mean the location of the project. That means any activity that is in competition where the company is doing business, and it is doing business in Utah.
Okay, thank you. You can go ahead with your other argument.
So the trial court found there was a probability of success on the merits. It found the plaintiff had no adequate remedy of law. It found that the violation of the covenant constitutes irreparable injury, and it found that the public's interest was served by enforcement of contracts. It knocked us out on the basis of what it called the balancing of equities, which was one of the factors under Rathke versus McFarland, the leading case. But the factors, there were four of them that were relied upon by the trial court in its so-called balancing of the equities, subvert both the explicit language of the party's contract and the purposes of an injunction. So I'd like to discuss some of those factors. The first was that the plaintiff will not receive these two particular projects should the defendant be enjoined. And of course, the purpose of an injunction is to prevent future harm. It doesn't really matter whether the plaintiff would get these jobs. There are an untold number of other jobs out there that the plaintiff is perfectly capable of getting and has a better chance of getting with one less competitor in the marketplace.
But did you present evidence of any other projects that the defendant was working on besides the two that you discussed in the trial court's order?
We didn't have evidence at that particular time. We presented those two jobs. She wiped her computer clean, so we weren't able to trace any other specific jobs. We did put on evidence of her website, which shows direct competition in Utah. I don't know, once we've shown those a violation of the covenant with respect to those particular jobs, or at least that the trial court found the one job, the gateway job, at that particular instance, the law presumes that an injunction should follow. In fact, the case law, Supreme Court case, says an injunction follows almost as a matter of course.
Well, actually, so that's a relatively old case that you're quoting there, which is not, I'm not saying it's bad law, I'm just wanting to make sure I got my chronology right. After that case, Rathke was announced, and it set forth the five to six factors that we're very familiar with, one of which is balancing of the equities. Do you think the presumption that the injunction should issue in a non-compete situation applies to the balance of the equities?
Yes.
And do you have any authority for that?
Yes, I do. I believe that is the employment television case, which I don't have the citation. It's in the brief, and that was decided long after Rathke, and still sets forth that there is a presumption. I think the Harrison versus Albright case also says that, and I'm not sure the year of that case. That may predate Rathke, but
it does.
I'm pretty sure, I thought that the employment television case stated the same thing.
Thank you.
But, and the injunction that you requested in your motion was not just an injunction with respect to the Gateway project or that other project in California, but it was to enjoin her from competing in Utah or Colorado within 200 miles of any place where the company does business. You asked for that broad language.
I asked to enforce the covenant not to compete.
Did you submit a proposed injunction to the court so we know what you were asking for?
A proposed order?
Proposed order?
No, we did not. Okay. I don't think the court asked for it. The court historically in this case has created its own orders.
But your motion asked for an injunction enforcing the covenant, but not specifically, you didn't specifically ask the court what language you wanted to be.
We put on evidence, Judge, in the form of the contract what that would be, and it would be to enforce this document.
Okay.
The second reason, beyond just that the purpose of the injunction is designed to protect future harm, is that the contract itself between the parties, if you look at the language, says that we were entitled, shall be entitled, to an injunction without showing. Let me get this exact language. Shall be entitled to injunctive relief without showing actual damage. And effectively what the court did by saying that we wouldn't get these jobs anyway was a requirement upon the plaintiff to show that it was going to have damages from these two particular jobs. And so both this particular factor that the trial court used, it fails to consider the future harm from any other breaches that might arise as a result of her competition, her continuing competition, her website, etc. And it also violated the contract because the contract didn't require us to show that we would have gotten the jobs. What if, for example, the defendant had set up a shop right next door to our store? Would we have been required to show that the customers that walked into that store would have purchased from us instead of from the defendant? The answer to that is obviously not. The purpose of the injunction was to stop the competition. We proved a breach, the trial court found a breach, and what follows should be, presumptively, an injunction. The second factor is closely tied to the first. The court just said, well, we didn't have a contract on the gateway job. And I want to come back to this question of mootness that you raised, because the trial court found that this particular job, this gateway project, which was approximately an $800,000 net profit job to my client, was not only within a 200-mile radius of what was then the store location in Park City, but was also within 200 miles of Gunnison, Colorado, which is where the company's principal place of business is. It's listed in all the corporate documents.
So in that analysis, the trial court was using the plaintiff's or your client's physical store as the point of the radius.
It found that the question was kind of moot because it was undisputed that it was also within 200 miles of Gunnison, Colorado. It made both findings.
Right, but both findings were premised on the point of the radius being where the physical store was.
That was true for Park City, but it was, the court never even, I don't think, listed the store location in Gunnison, but it was obviously within 200 miles of any place in Gunnison.
Okay, thank you.
So the third factor that this trial court relied upon was that the defendant did not instigate the breach. That is, the court found, somewhat incredibly to me, but I'll accept that finding because we are here, that the customers coincidentally stopped working with my client and 10 days later started working with her, and that they contacted her directly to do so. So that is an issue of a breach of the non-solicitation clause. Has nothing to do with whether or not she is or is not competing. It would be no different again if she set up a storefront and she's not soliciting customers to come in, but they come in anyway. Competition is different from solicitation.
But counsel, I don't read the court's order as saying that that factor was relevant to whether there was competition. I thought the court was saying that factor was relevant to balancing of the equities.
And
why is it totally irrelevant to the equities, in your view?
Because the purpose of the injunction is to prevent future harm. So if whether she instigated the contact with these particular customers doesn't tell you anything about what happens to the next customer. We've shown that she breached the contract. We've shown you that she's got her own website, that she's advertising for new jobs. Somewhat inconsistent, by the way, that she's advertising for new jobs but didn't instigate the contact with customers. But in any event, we're talking about the future harm that could accrue to my client, not just from these jobs. And that's why it's relevant. I have approximately 3 minutes that I'd like to reserve.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Luke Danielson, registration 6952. With me is Sarah Coleman, registration 43974. We're attorneys for the FLE, Suzanne Geigel. I did want to preface my argument here by saying that we would like to really focus on the facts as shown by the record here. I would disagree with Mr. Weinberg's characterization that anybody stopped working with my chance. The record itself and the testimony shows that these clients were told by Ms. Geigel, give my chance a chance to keep doing business, and they never heard from them at all. The testimony of both my chance's president, Mr. Hauer, and the two customers is uncontroverted and entirely consistent. They waited by the phone and they never heard from my chance. So the idea that they, quote, stopped doing business with my chance has no support in the record, and I'd urge the court simply to rely on the record itself for that. The second point I'd make is as to location. I am sorry we had to wait till we got here to hear this, but basically I would suggest that if in fact there is no physical location at which my chance has a store in Utah, many of the issues before this court are moot. Specifically the ones about can my client in her kitchen be ordering something from a manufacturer in North Carolina for a client in Nantucket, right? And the relief that was sought in this case would have prohibited her from making internet contact or telephone contact if she was within 200 miles. I would urge the court to follow what Professor Chidlaw up at the University of Colorado Law School always used to say, read the contract. you know, read the language of the covenant not to compete, and it says any location at which the company does business.
And why wouldn't that include the client?
Well, for one thing, that's a shifting base. You know, if my client, you know, would have to be kept advised on a daily basis of wherever they are servicing a client. You know, I think in that way it's unreasonable to expect her to adapt her activities to a constantly shifting location, right?
And well, depends how you read the contract, of course, like Chippewa says. Sure. Corporation does, any place where the corporation does business, that could be anywhere. But then it says any place where it does business in the states of Utah and Colorado, which could be anywhere in the state of Utah. I mean, the injunction could have been she can't engage in business if it was to be given anywhere in the states of Utah and Colorado. The reason I asked counsel whether proposed injunction was tendered, so that I would like to have seen what it was exactly that they wanted it to say. He says there wasn't one, so I will have to look at their motion to try to understand that. But for purposes of this argument, it doesn't really matter, does it? Because what the judge found was that the Gateway project is within 200 miles of the location in Gunnison, so I think we can go on and deal with those, with the facts as they are. We still, it's still not moved with respect to that point.
There is, look, Your Honor, first of all, let me say one of the things about saying, well, anywhere in Utah or Colorado that they do business, and interpreting that to mean, you know, they have a meeting at, in an office somewhere and they're doing business. It reads the 200 mile limit out and essentially says anywhere in Colorado or Utah that they choose to have a client. Beyond that, I think the other mootness issue, and I think it's important to be addressed here, is what is the business these people are in? Hardware stores aren't competing necessarily with farm implement stores. What I would ask the court to do would be to look at the suggestion of mootness in which the president of the of My Chance is quoted in the newspaper saying they're no longer going to be selling furniture, they're going to become a furniture manufacturer, right? And I'd like to ask the court to refer particularly to the trial court's finding 16, in which he said, my client, her practice is limited to design and that she has no retail operation at all. And finding 30, which he says the evidence suggests that the plaintiff is a retail furniture business. If now, according, I have only what I can, I've offered the court, I have no more information than that, but the president of the company is quoted in the material we submitted as saying they're no longer going even to do retail business, they're going to become a furniture manufacturer.
You seem to be, unless I'm mistaken, you seem to be raising factual questions about what's going on with the business of My Chance. I mean, how can we as an appellate court resolve these factual questions that are raised sort of vaguely in the suggestion for mootness?
Well, I would think that at a minimum, if you were to rule for our opponents, that this means there's enough murkiness about this that it ought to be sent back to the trial court for further proceedings, including both the question of what's the scope of any injunction that's issued and some of these underlying facts about what exact business are they in and where are they doing. So
thank you
Judge. The other point I'd simply make is we went into this hearing, as the record reflects, with a real scattergun approach. My client was accused of violating every single term of this non-compete. The court found that there was absolutely no evidence that she was soliciting employees. There was absolutely no evidence that she was trying to interfere with business relationships. There was no evidence that she was the trade secret claim that she was misappropriating trade secrets just simply has evaporated. It was a big deal at the time of the preliminary injunction hearing. What we've come down to, I think, really is Gateway. And with respect to that, let me just simply say that all the evidence, Gateway aside, there is no evidence that my client has done anything else to compete with the company. There's no evidence of solicitation. Yes, you're...
How did... you can finish, but I'm so curious, but how did the court find then that the violation constitutes irreparable injury on the one hand, and yet you say there was no evidence of anything that you did to hurt the company except maybe with respect to the Gateway contract? I have a hard time, you see, reconciling those two findings, that there is irreparable injury, but they had no chance to get the Gateway contract anyway.
Well, I could have multiple interpretations of that. One interpretation of that is that the court was going back to some of these cases that said there's sort of a presumption of irreparable injury.
In the violation of covenant not to compete.
Yeah, if there's a violation of a covenant. I think basically the issue here is if all you have to show is that there's a covenant that's in existence and the employee left the company, and that's all you have to show, then, you know, there probably should be an injunction issue. But
well, what do we do with the case law that says, as your opponent points out, that there's a presumption that the factors for an injunction are satisfied in the context of a non-compete agreement?
I draw a distinction between all of the factors being satisfied and the irreparable harm factor being satisfied. I think there's some language in some of those cases that I think is maybe intended to be focused on irreparable harm. I think, you know, it's clear that at least some of those cases focus simply on the factor of irreparable harm. It doesn't say the other five Rathke factors are irrelevant. And I think that's one of the issues before this court is if you're to accept those cases, do you accept them as referring to all six Rathke factors, which incidentally is an argument that wasn't presented to the trial court, or do you regard them as being simply relevant to the one factor of is there irreparable injury? I would say those irreparable injury cases, if there's another thing I could distinguish them on, they're sale of business cases, almost all of them. They're almost all sale of business cases. And I think in that kind of situation, it may be different from this kind of case here where we're talking about a former employee. In any case, I guess my point is, if all you have to do is show that there's a covenant and somebody left the company, I don't think that that's what any of the cases say. I think you have to show something.
Sorry to interrupt you. But didn't the plaintiff show more than that? The plaintiff showed actual ongoing competition, not just the possibility of it.
Well, what is that actual ongoing competition? Yes, she's still in business. She's taking clients in San Diego, California, and Nantucket, and Florida, and Idaho. Is she competing within the prohibited range? The evidence is she took great steps to avoid it.
What about Gateway? Why don't we focus on that?
Let's go to Gateway and say, I think the key issue there is where's the effort? You know, I think the Gateway client was told by my client, my chance needs to have an opportunity to do this business with you. The testimony is uncontroverted from both my chance president and from the client. No one ever contacted me.
But what is, I don't dispute those facts, and that seems to be what the trial court found, but how are those facts relevant to the non-compete language in the agreement?
I think they're relevant to the balancing of equities, Your Honor. I think the question is, if we go back to Reed Mill and some of these other cases, they say reasonableness of a covenant really requires two things. One of them is there has to be, if you're going to enforce it, there has to be some benefit to the plaintiff, and you need to avoid undue hardship to the defendant. Question, what's the benefit to the plaintiff of an injunction saying she can't work on the Gateway project? And I think the court balanced that equity correctly and said they had a chance. They've never contacted her. They've got some people who are halfway through a project who would really like some help, and who incidentally have now, later, had a dispute with the plaintiff and said that it will be a cold day in hell before we ever do anything with them. So the question is, what benefit does the plaintiff receive?
I think it's a good question. I think what I heard your opponent say was the harm is the competition itself, and so the injunction would give them the benefit of stopping the competition.
Well, you know, I guess I would start by saying that our economic system is based on competition, that there's a presumption that's set out in all the leading cases that public policy disfavors covenants that restrict competition, that they're enforceable only if they meet the statutory criteria and only if they're reasonable, and I would say only according to their language, unless the court should choose to restrict that language. It has to be oriented toward the legitimate interests, is the regional language. It has to be oriented toward protecting the legitimate interests of the plaintiff. So I guess the question is, what legitimate interest of the plaintiff does it serve to deny the defendant business that they aren't going to have and that they have not sought, right? Question, if this business is really that important to them, why didn't they ever seek it? The evidence is uncontroverted. They never made any attempt to continue the project. And I think the issue there is very likely that they, you know, the evidence seemed to be at the preliminary injunction hearing that they are in the retail business selling furniture. And but they didn't
On that point, is that fact true, assuming it's true, because their only designer, the defendant, left and then started competing against them?
Well, the testimony of Mr. Hauer, the president, was I could do that job. It's in the record. I could do that myself. I have enough design capacity.
So he considered himself a designer, is what you're
he
saying?
He considered himself a designer. Okay?
Thank you.
So, My point there simply is, if this is such a big deal, where is any effort on the part of my chance to pursue either of these jobs, and what is the harm if defendant is pursuing work for clients who are stuck halfway through a project and who don't have anything to do with the dispute between plaintiff and defendant at the request of the client? At the requests of the client, it's clear that my client backed off, gave my chance an opportunity to do this business, and in either case, did either of the clients ever hear from my chance again?
Assuming that Mr. Hauer does remain in the design business, doesn't just sell furniture, wouldn't it have been appropriate to enter an injunction prohibiting Ms. Geibel from competing with him in the design business within a 200-mile radius of Gunnison, except for the Gateway Project, because he funded on that one? Wouldn't that have been
Then I guess it comes back to, doesn't the plaintiff still have to meet some burden of proof? You know, if I have an employee who leaves my law firm, do I just walk into court and say the employee left, I want an injunction, or do I have to have some kind of evidence that all the evidence in this case is that she was extremely careful not to compete within what?
I guess it depends how you define compete. But if she's seeking clients within a other than Gateway, 200-mile radius of Gunnison, where they have their place of business, it seems like she's arguably competing with them in violation of the covenant, which the court said is enforceable.
The evidence at the hearing, it's in the record, was that she has received contacts from people saying, I would like you to come remodel my house, or I'd like you to help design something. She said no. She said, I can't do it.
Within a 200-mile radius of Gunnison.
Well, there is no example of anyone within a 200-mile radius of Gunnison. There are numerous examples that are in the testimony about people within a 200-mile radius of Park City, and the evidence is uncontroverted in each case. She said, no, I cannot do this business. Okay? So she isn't out there. The evidence is she's being very careful not to compete within what this radius is, and the Gateway Project is the only issue.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
So let's be clear, Your Honors, Ms. Geibel is a member and remains a member of the board of directors of this company. She has fiduciary duties over and above the contract, and she's still out there in competition with the business. So Mr. Danielson says, well, why didn't we seek the Gateway project when she left? First of all, Ms. Geibel was the lead designer and was the primary contact. That's either a finding of the court or all over the evidence in the testimony. So who is the customer going to continue to do business with? They're going to continue to do business with the person that was fulfilling that function. And it was only a 10-day window between the time that she left and the business started being was shifted over to Ms. Geibel. Mr. Danielson also argued that there needs to be some benefit to the plaintiff in enforcing the covenant not to compete, and I would submit to you that that is completely contrary to what the parties agreed to in the covenant itself, because it precluded her, the injunction shall issue without a showing of any actual damages.
But we still have the Rafferty factors, which require us to look at the balancing, or require the trial court to look at the balancing of the equities, in addition to the irreparable harm issue.
It is, Judge, but I've given you any number of cases in the reply brief where courts give deference to the party's contractual agreement because of the principle of freedom of contract.
But at the hearing below, did you argue that the Rafferty was inapplicable because of the contract language?
We did argue that it was inapplicable because of the contract language, and I don't think it's necessarily inapplicable. I think the court has to first look at the party's agreement, and unless there's something unreasonable about what the parties set up front, the court has to apply a presumption, which means Rafferty is satisfied, and the burden then shifts over to the defendant to disprove those factors.
It seems like you're suggesting that the injunction should be issued to punish Ms. Geibel, even though there's no benefit to the plaintiff from it.
Again,
because they agreed to that, notwithstanding the cases that Mr. Danielson cites, which says the courts aren't supposed to do that.
Well, first of all, it's not to punish Ms. Geibel, although
penalize.
The employment television case says to the contrary. It's future. What's going to happen in the future? And so if these customers wouldn't have gone to us, you know, so be it. But what about the next Gateway? You know, that's why there is an injunction. And as Judge Navarro indicated, you know, that is really what we're concerned about. I mean, Gateway is still there. She's still competing. And that's wrong as a fiduciary. And I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case is submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.